This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World on the RBN Radio Network. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And today we're going to talk again about energy issues. And I want to kind of go back in history, give a little bit of background on myself. You know, I've done a lot of radio over the years, mostly on technology areas. And from time to time, we get into some of these areas of climate change and its impact, as well as sort of the run-up and the impact of energy-related issues. And I want to talk about it from a standpoint of oil and gas. And I come from a state. I'm here in Alaska today, which is my home. I was actually born here before Alaska was a state. In fact, it was when it was a territory. The big issue that brought Alaska into statehood was, in fact, the discovery of oil in Cook Inlet, which is in south-central Alaska. At the same time, Hawaii's strategic importance was being looked at. This was the late and middle 1950s. It was obvious that it was an important place. And in fact, at the time, Hawaii was predominantly Republican. Alaska was predominantly Democratic. So there was a balance in the U.S. Senate by bringing in essentially both states at the same time. One was over energy. One was over the strategic importance of being in the middle of the Pacific, which, you know, we learned a lot from World War II in terms of how valuable Hawaii was to national defense. The issue of oil and gas in Alaska has always, and in fact, minerals generally have always driven national policy in Alaska. You know, back in 1867, when Alaska was purchased under the Agreement of Secession from the Russians, the deal was, you know, the big deal was at that time furs, and the fur industry had pretty well run out. There was some thought that maybe there was gold in Alaska, and of course, by the 1880s and 1890s, that happened. We had a huge rush, several gold rushes up until the beginning of World War II, where they shut down all of the mining in the United States that wasn't considered strategically important, and gold and silver and those things at that time weren't. What also happened in Alaska is additional discoveries in Cook Inlet of oil, and the way they discovered that oil is essentially by surface seeps, where the oil had actually come to the surface of the ground. The same thing happened in the early 50s when they discovered oil on the north slope of Alaska in what is now known as the National Naval Petroleum Reserve. If you look at a map of Alaska, one of the government maps, you'll see a very large area, the size of most eastern states, as a matter of fact, sitting in the northern part of central Alaska, just to the left of Prudhoe Bay, looking at a map of the state. This region, again, discovered because of oil seeps coming to the surface of the ground. If you look at the entire northern region of Alaska, it's essentially an oil basin or series of basins, as is most of the Arctic Ocean in the northern part above Alaska. That actually covers northern Europe. It also covers Russia and the North Siberian areas as well. All of these areas are known for oil basins, oil reserves, northern Canada as well, and essentially containing some of the last large North American reserves are here in Alaska. In fact, they suggest that maybe our oil reserves in the mid-80s, where everybody was looking at Saudi Arabia as the biggest reserve in those days, there was some consideration that Alaska might, in fact, be equal in what it holds in oil and gas here. Now, what happened with Alaska in terms of the oil prices, you know, the prices weren't very much. The idea of getting oil out of the North Slope in the 60s was a pretty far-fetched idea, yet even at, you know, low oil prices of a few dollars a barrel compared to the $71, $72 barrel prices we've seen in recent days, was it sufficient to justify what at that time was the biggest private investment ever made, which turned into the $9 billion Trans-Alaska Pipeline? The music's coming up. We're going to the break. I'm going to continue the story when we come back. And then this is going to lead into the whole discussion of energy policy and where we are today and where maybe some of our solutions are. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. Appreciate you being with me. Today we're talking about energy and sort of the energy policy that evolved here in Alaska, because it does, in fact, affect the entire nation. You know, Alaska produces approximately 20% of domestic oil, and quite frankly, we could produce significantly more with existing fields. And there's some problems to that, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go on today. You know, going back to the North Slope and Prudhoe Bay, in 1969, we had the Prudhoe Bay oil leases, and these leases were held on state land. It generated nearly $1 billion in revenue, which was an unheard of sum for Alaskans in 1969. What happened then is the issue of the right-of-way. You know, how would they build this pipeline and what right-of-way would they follow? And at the time, they had no settlement of any of the indigenous land claims here in Alaska. You know, there were no treaties, per se, with the 228 tribal governments that existed here, half the tribes in the United States, 458 in total. Over half of those are here located in Alaska. Those tribes weren't actually recognized as governments until 1993. Most of them were recognized under the Clinton administration and given a domestic nation status, which is similar to what tribes have in other parts of the country. But back in 1971, the arguments over how could they finance the biggest privately constructed project ever undertaken and yet not know for sure, you know, what the underlying land titles were. About that time, 1970, my dad got elected to the 92nd Congress as Alaska's only member of the United States House of Representatives. And his first piece of legislation was, in fact, the Native Land Claims Settlement Act, which was, again, a big number for Alaskans. It was just under $1 billion in cash and 44 million acres transferred to indigenous Americans here in our region of the world. And this was the biggest land settlement in the history of the United States with Native Americans. What it did, from most people's perspective at least, is clear the way for that right-of-way. And then that was the next major piece of legislation, the pipeline right-of-way. And if you remember back in 71, 72, 73, this is when these debates were taking place. This is also when 73, the oil embargo from the Middle East and the formation of OPEC, a new organization at that time, now, you know, really regulating the price and production of oil globally. At that time, you know, all of those factors sort of coalesced, and, you know, there was a big fight over building this pipeline. In fact, in the U.S. Senate, it was a tie vote. It was a 50-50 tie in the Senate, broken by Agnew just before he was thrown out of office during the Watergate scandals. But it was a tie vote. It did pass with Agnew's additional vote as the Senate president. And what you saw in the end was the Trans-Alaska Pipeline eventually get built. It was built to carry 2 million barrels of oil a day, which it did through many of its initial years. All of that oil was destined for U.S. refineries because part of the compromise, there were actually two major pieces of the compromise. One is it could only be used domestically. There was an embargo against exporting Alaskan crude oil, so it really had to feed the domestic need. And we went up to 2 million of barrels a day at our peak production. What has happened since is the law has changed as oil supplies in the rest of the world and during the glut of oil supplies when no one was really paying much attention, the export ban was lifted from Alaskan oil. Most of that oil now flows to Japan and into Asia. The other thing that a lot of folks don't understand about Alaskan oil and gas policy is the choke points in moving oil from Alaska. The choke points aren't the pipeline at the present time and really isn't the field itself because there's plenty of oil if you want to put it in the line. The difficulty is double tanker hulls at the point of discharge down at Valdez, the southern part of the state, you know, where this oil is shipped. In tankers, double-hulled steel tankers to haul oil are in extremely short supply right now. And that's primarily because of the demand in Southeast Asia and Asia for raw commodities, particularly oil. Right now, there are no tankers available, even if we could produce the kind of oil that America's demanding right now. The other issue is refining capacity, and refineries have not been built to keep pace with world demand, and that's, again, another choke point. In the process. The rest of the distribution scheme you know, for oil and gas is probably pretty solid. But, you know, again, these are the bottlenecks that aren't quickly remedied. And with the economies expanding at double digits in Asia, where huge populations are consuming increasingly larger amounts of these products, we're going to see the price continue to rise, or they're going to find new supplies and produce those supplies. But there's no time to build the necessary infrastructures to process what's in demand. That again is a big choke point. But the other big part of the compromise in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Alaska Lands Act was the D2 provisions, which provided for parks and preserves in Alaska. We have more parks and preserves in this state than probably any place in the United States. You know, Alaska during statehood back in 1958, unlike many states, we gave up our surface estate, the surface land, in exchange for underlying mineral resources. And our deal with the U.S. government was that 90% of all rents and royalties on oil and gas, coal, and every other mineral that's produced in Alaska on federal lands, 90% of that revenue under our statehood act, under our agreement with everyone else, was to flow to the Alaskan Treasury. Well, during the ANWR debate, and this is the debate on the oil field on the other side of Prudhoe Bay, on the right side, this is the one that's being debated periodically because our congressional delegation is insisting on opening the ANWR. But the ANWR is probably the most sensitive area. There's, as I said, the other side is the National Naval Petroleum Reserve, plenty of oil there. But the way it works is you always attack the most difficult fields, the ones that are the most controversial. When you have a climate of high energy prices and lots of problems related to that, from the heat waves that are affecting many parts of the country right now, many parts of the world, to the opposite extreme when we hit the winter months coming up. But when you have that sense of emergency is where the pressure comes and why the ANWR probably will eventually open up. I mean, my guess is it'll pass on one of those margin votes of 50-50 and a tie vote being decided or something fairly close to that. And I think that's what we'll see. Again, it's not going to resolve the problem if we have no refineries or a way to get the oil to those refineries. The other thing that has happened is the D2 provision that locked up lands. What happened in the lockup were two things. First, we found out that the Congress, after fighting it to the U.S. Supreme Court, could change the state's royalty share, take away a percentage of that revenue. In fact, for the ANWR, if it opens up, it's a 50-50 deal. They violate our statehood agreement, and apparently they can. I guess it's the same as all agreements with the federal government. They tend to change over time to suit whoever's in the position, whatever lobby efforts are behind it. You know, and in this case, it's the oil and gas industry. But when you look at the second provision, which was really kind of a mystery, you know, in the mid-80s, there was this big fight over Alaska lands, what would be reserved in parks and preserves. In fact, going back even into the 70s, when Jimmy Carter was in office, what he actually did is take a look at Alaska and survey all the strategic minerals here. And there were 33 on our list. You know, this is like tin, molybdenum, iron. You know, all of the critical minerals that are important to national defense and to our national economy, 32 of the 33 strategic minerals were found in Alaska in world-class mineable quantities. And promptly, the majority of those were locked up in parks and preserves. And people were mystified by why was the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and all of these industrially-based foundations or families backing the lockup of resources in Alaska. And people thought it was great. You know, the environmentalists, at least, thought it was great. The rest of us were kind of mystified by it. But when you think about it, consider this. Before that lockup of the lands in Alaska, any U.S. citizen 18 years or older was entitled to go on those federal lands that were open for mineral exploration and make discoveries and lay claim under the 1800s various mining acts that allowed us the privilege of doing that as Americans. Once they were locked up into parks and preserve, that right went away, and what it was replaced with was a regulatory body of rules and regulations that could be overturned by an emergency order, an executive order even, under emergency conditions in the United States. And then you have to ask, who gets those reserves. And if you think about it, it was pretty well orchestrated. It took it out of the hands of the people once again, the average person, placed it in the hands of government as a reserve, as a safety deposit box for the multinational companies that would one day be afforded the opportunity to exploit those resources. And that's exactly the way things have begun to shape up. As demand for minerals, as demand and uncertainty in the world continues, we'll see those resources, those national resources allocated, in fact, to multinational companies for their exploitation. When you think about this state, we have tremendous energy resources. If you just look at some of the traditional resources of coal, we have approximately 2,000 years of domestic coal in Alaska. If you look at any of the oil and gas areas in Alaska, and almost two-thirds of this state are potential oil and gas areas or oil and gas basins. You look at the minerals from molybdenum to lead to zinc, we have it all here. We're going on the break. I'm going to talk again as we come back again about sort of the minerals and energy policies of Alaska as it relates to the rest of the country. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World. You're listening to RBN Live. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and it's Wednesday, and we're pleased to have you with us. If you want to call in today and get in on today's conversation, it's 800-313-9443. Again, that's 800-313-9443. You know, going back again to this, the history of sort of what happened here, you know, Alaska, many people don't realize that, you know, there's more roads in probably Dallas County than there is in the state of Alaska. Most of us live on the road system that live here. You know, when you look at Alaska and those that have been here and have experienced this place, it's just unbelievably vast. I mean, most of it's never even been looked at. When you look at the areas that have been explored by people, most of it took place 80, 90 years ago on foot during the last gold rush. And since that time, our glaciers, our ice coat has essentially been removed by about 40 or 50% since the turn of the century 100 years ago. As a consequence, a lot of areas have opened up that are being looked at again, and new things are being discovered. The fact is, most of this now is being done by the large multinationals. It's a very big change. You know, there used to be, as a young child growing up, you're still a vibrant, family-oriented, small mining operations throughout Alaska, very similar to the family farm in many parts of the country that also have sort of diminished and gone away and been replaced. When you look at all of this, what it's really a discussion about is the national wealth. You know, what underlies the land on national properties belongs to each and every one of us, and how those resources are managed and used can either benefit us or not. You know, here in Alaska, Prudhoe Bay, just one of many, many oil basins within the state, right afterwards we had a really wonderful governor that had the view that and a vision to set up what became the Alaska Permanent Fund. And 25% of all of our energy resource rents, what we collected as the landlord against the multinationals, 25% of that money went into a fund that was invested by a non-politically appointed board, a board that didn't, you know, you couldn't change them out anytime you changed the governor. And what has happened with that fund, it's grown to over $30 billion, and it issues out this year. They're predicting every Alaskan resident will receive a check for $1,100 as our share of that wealth. And what they did is set a formula in place so the fund earns money. On a floating five-year average, its average earnings are split. Half stay in the fund and half go to the people. And this happens every year in the fall. We don't have a state income tax here. We don't have a state property tax here. And we don't have a state sales tax here. The only state taxes we have are corporate taxes when you make over $250,000 net, and excise taxes, oil and gas, and some of the industrial taxes on our resources. We have a 3% fish tax. We produce probably the last of the largest fisheries, in fact, in the world is Alaska. You know, so we produce resource-based revenues that then actually benefit every single person that lives here in a very, very dramatic way. In rural Alaska, where we have 40% unemployment, it provides the basic money for energy supplies for households to get them through the winter. You know, the fact is Alaska is really a unique place. I mean, we're a third world country in one hand and a modern country in another when you look at how this state is configured. You know, as being part of the United States, we have all of the attributes of a modern technology and all the things that that offers. But in rural Alaska, we still don't have running water in a lot of communities. You know, things people don't really understand in terms of our region. Yet we're one of the wealthiest regions in the world. We only have 700,000 people that live here and 586,000 square miles of surface real estate and the longest coastline in the country. Our coast, when you consider the Aleutian Islands, is bigger than the West Coast, East Coast, and Gulf Coast combined. When you consider that, and you look at what that entails, it's dramatic. And, you know, Alaska as a resource really could resolve many of the problems we're facing today that have led us into conflicts around the world. When you think about energy alone, we talked a little bit about the coal, a little bit about the oil, and a little bit about the gas. What we haven't talked about are the alternatives that we also have here and what those alternatives mean in terms of the future. You know, we have geothermal resources in Alaska sufficient to be used to create enough hydrogen by cracking hydrogen out of just plain water. In other words, we can generate electricity with geothermal here that has already been done in proven technologies. They use it in Iceland. They use it in other parts of the world. And actually create enough hydrogen to feed a hydrogen-based economy if we actually head that way. You know, and that's done with a renewable resource, geothermal power. If you look at the wind resources that are located in the same region, the same could be said. You know, there's tremendous domestic resources of renewables that aren't being looked at all. In fact, back in the early 70s, when I contrast where we are now, where we were then, you know, we were panicking over not having any oil and not just the price of it, but it was declared an emergency. You know, it was a national emergency. It was a national crisis, the fact that we had gas lines. This time, it's not a crisis. You know, there's no, the price is going up, but there seems to be enough supply at least to meet the demand in the U.S., but the price is going up. It should be an emergency. Why isn't it? You know, the supplies are there, so the corporations this time are making money. We're going to the break, and we're going to talk about why this isn't a crisis today and who's making the money on this disaster on the backs of the American people. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World, and you're listening to RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're here every Wednesday on RBN Live. And pass the message on to your friends and let people know if this show is of interest to you. You can also call in at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. Going back to this issue of Alaska lands and resources and sort of how that all translates and impacts national policy, you know, we're pretty far removed. It's 1,500 miles to the next U.S. city to get to Seattle from here. You know, it's a long distance, and we're separated by a lot of miles. So things that happen here often don't make it over the AP wires and really, quite frankly, just don't make it into the mainstream media outlets, and yet they really do affect a great deal of what happens in national policy. You know, the most powerful U.S. senator today is our Senator Ted Stevens, who creates a lot of solutions for Alaska and a lot of problems for us and everyone else as well. And I think his history recently on the Bridges to Nowhere and some of his other projects pretty much illustrate, you know, where power can be misused. And a lot of money wasted. You know, when you look at this crisis that we're in right now, and I call it an energy crisis because anyone on fixed incomes, and that is a increasing, ever-increasing segment of our population, are being forgotten. You know, we have a situation where people are dying right now across the country because of a heat wave and a lack of energy supplies. We're going to have people dying this winter for the same reason. At the same time, this winter, when these elections clear, you're going to see back again double-digit inflation, which is going to have a dramatic impact, again, on the elderly and the retired and those on fixed incomes. And the rest of us, quite frankly, paying twice as much this year as a little over a year or two ago for fuel supplies and heat. Now we're going to see it impact everything that we buy, because manufacturers and producers, quite frankly, can't keep the dogs away. You know, they've got to pass those costs on, and we're going to see it in the agricultural area. I think we're going to see again another long line of small farmers going through the roughest time ever because of high energy prices, fertilizer costs, the things it takes to run the family farm have placed them at risk again, not being able to meet their obligations when they come due in the fall, unless commodity prices on food are high enough to make up the difference, and they just may not be there quite yet. You know, when you look at energy as the basic component in the U.S., we consume probably 30% of all of the world's energy that's produced. And, you know, we produce an awful lot with that. If you take that out of the economy or you add significant cost to that, the impact is unbelievably dramatic. The problem is it's being suppressed right now because the oil industry realizes if it goes any further, you know, there's a lot of people upset, feel like those windfall profits ought to be taxed, that they ought not to be allowed to profiteer on everyone else's misfortune. And some of those resources put back into solving the problem, not just providing perhaps some subsidies to those that can't afford fuel, but to look beyond that to solutions that take us out of the trap. And that's what we're missing. You know, in the 70s, they had tax incentives for innovation. They had tax incentives for homeowners to do things that converted or conserved energy. They had ways to stimulate the economy to look at those alternatives and begin to implement them. And I think today, where it even makes more economic sense, where the solutions are available, if there was the money around to fuel them. I mean, most homeowners, if they were asked, hey, if you could lower your fuel bill by X and it cost you less than you're paying out now, would you do it? And the answer is yes, if there was a mechanism or a way to accomplish it. None of those mechanisms are being created, and none of those programs are being resurrected and looked at, the ones that worked successfully then. And yet our dependence is even more strong today on foreign oil than it was in the 70s. You know, when you look at Brazil that went through the same thing, and I've mentioned it on radio programs before, Brazil realized what happened during the energy crisis, and they set a government policy at the national level to be independent in energy. And their goal was to be independent in energy, so they didn't need any foreign imports of any kind of petroleum product to any great degree. And that's exactly what they've achieved. They have, as the largest country in South America, and virtually no oil and gas supplies, using alternatives to produce fuels for automobiles and industry without relying on imports. That is a tremendous, tremendous thing for a third world country to be able to accomplish. And what did that accomplishment yield to them? They had one of the most unstable governments. They used to change them out like most people change their socks. You know, these guys went through more governments and more upheaval. At the same time, their currency, you know, periodically would go through hyperinflation periods where it'd be completely devalued. And a lot of it had to do with its balance of payments, its production. When you start to get away from imported energy sources, all of a sudden, everything changes. In the case of Brazil, their currency got stronger and their government got stronger, and their dependence on others dropped, which meant they had their sovereignty back. They didn't have to bend on the whim of those that drive energy. And, you know, this administration, the one that's sitting here today, in their first 4 years, had a huge set of initiatives dealing with the oil and gas and energy industries, had meetings in the White House. None of that data has ever been released. In fact, they fought it every time it comes up. The plan for energy in the country and the planning that took place in the closet has resulted in the highest oil prices in the history of the world and the worst deficits for the national treasury. You know, these oil prices also translate into spending because local governments have to buy fuel for everything from school buses, you know, to repair trucks. When you look at the federal government's expenditures in this area and the military expenditures in this area, they are huge. And we're absorbing all of that. And in many places, other programs get cut. School districts across the country are cutting programs, maybe valuable programs, just to get the kids to and from school because people can't stand any more increases in local taxes to cover it. Energy is the central theme, and energy independence as a national emergency, as a national goal, ought to be there in this election season. There's plenty of opportunity to start to raise this issue as politicians come banging on our doors. Energy is we are in an energy crisis. Just because there's a supply that appears to keep lines from forming at the pumps doesn't change the disaster occurring in many people's lives right now. We've got Marilyn in California hanging on, so I'm going to go ahead and take that call. Marilyn, are you still with me?
Good morning, Dr. Begich.
Good morning.
Everything I'm listening to you say today makes me think that there is a concerted effort by those in charge of our government to actually destroy our infrastructure and make sure we don't have enough energy to go on at this point. Would you agree with that statement at all?
I do, actually. I think it's both by design and default. I think we've got a lot of ignorance in terms of what's actually happened in energy policy. At the same time, when you look at who's fueling the fire of politicians and campaigns around the country, it's not you and me writing those $10,000 campaign checks. It's, you know, it's all of the industrialists that are making, you know, the 300 times our salary wage levels. You know, the fact is industry pushes what's in their self-interest, and, you know, it's corporations do as well. You know, what is their self-interest? Ultimately, it's making profits for their shareholders. But national policy should be separate from government just because of that. I mean, when you think of national policy, it should be a woven fabric that makes sense, not a patchwork quilt of special legislation by lobbyists. And that's where we've really lost it because, you know, I mean, look, if you think about it in your own household, you know, energy prices doubling was a crisis. You know, we all began to address it by cutting budgets, changing the way we approached it, turning the lights off. I mean, whatever we could do that we were empowered enough to do with our knowledge, we did. The Congress has access to tremendous knowledge that they're failing to use for the benefit of the American population. And energy policy is one of those areas. And I think there is a conspiracy of multinational interest to maintain the status quo, and that is not in the public's interest any longer.
You know, on a related topic to energy, I know that you also have talked about HARP and weather modification.
Yep.
And we just went through an unprecedented, at least a week long, I live here in Northern California, which is normally this time of the year socked in with fog.
Right.
And it's amazing, we've had very clear weather. I'm one of those chemtrail nuts. We used to see chemtrails on a daily basis for a couple of years.
Yeah.
We have been through an unprecedented clarity of sky, gorgeous, but then we have this week-long 100-plus degree temperatures. I've never seen it, okay? Now, the impact of that was not only the worst was people dying in droves.
Right.
But look at what it's done, and you barely see it in the paper. They had to slaughter, or they many, many cattle and poultry died in the Central Valley because over
right.
there it was up 115 or so.
Right.
Then you lost, I have a feeling that the news will come out, the grape crop is probably ruined. You know, all the drinkers and the wine bibbers will probably lose out. But if you look at the damage it's done to the crops, plus
yep.
the unprecedented two-month-long rain every day from January to February here in
right.
California, my mind goes spinning when I think about, isn't it possible using extra low-frequency waves to stall a front or to use this river of water that floats above the atmosphere to cause rain or to stall a high-pressure area like they, you know, they said it on the news. The weatherman every night would go, oh, I don't know why this high pressure
right.
is just unprecedented. Isn't it possible to do that?
It is, actually. There's two bills that have been kind of floating around the Congress to try and set up some regulation on private enterprises and you know, use of weather modification technologies. There's some international treaties about this, but nothing domestically, per se, that would limit someone experimenting either independently or as a government within the boundaries of their own country. In fact, it's specifically, you know, allowed within the treaties.
U.S. could do it, but, I mean, we could do it, but Russia, according to the treaty, couldn't do it. And we know Russia has that capability because they've farmed it out and, get people to pay for it, right?
Sure. And the reality is, if you can do it within the boundaries of your own country, it's kind of foolish to think that the nature recognizes political boundaries, lines drawn on a map. Geography dictates and geophysics dictate weather, and so and the way weather flows through a region. And, you know, this is, you know, when you're looking at the complications of man interference with weather systems and then the downstream effects, that is a huge, huge risk, and one that scientists that I'm in touch with who are involved in that specific area of research are very, very concerned about. The other issue is the natural cycles, which I think are even playing, you know, more into everything right now. It's like anything man does now is like just another straw on the camel's back, or another rock in your backpack swimming across the lake. It's just going to sink us. And, you know, when you look at climate, you know, what drives so much of climate is ocean temperatures. And when you look at ocean temperatures, people always have used the equations of looking at the sun and the solar radiation and what's happening in the atmosphere that allows conditions for the oceans to heat. What's being missed, and I've said this before, is the volcanics under the seas, which drive even more of that heat engine in the oceans, because light coming from the sun, most of the heat energy is reflected from the surface. And if you go deeper and deeper into the sea, even just a few feet, it gets cooler and cooler and cooler because heat rises. It's basic law of physics. The colder temperatures stay down deep. When you have energy released from volcanic venting or volcanic activity under the seas, 100% of the energy is absorbed into the ocean, and it would look like a plume, like an El Nino. In the South Pacific, there's 1,200 undersea volcanoes that have been charted. In the North Pacific, a similar number. And at any given time, a number of these are going off, releasing, you know, billions and billions of BTUs of energy into the seas. And that, those slight temperature changes then alter all kinds of weather conditions above. And so when you see all of this, like in the Pacific, I think we're going to see over the next couple of years increasingly more and more dramatic storms originating in the Pacific, not just the Atlantic, because of this heat driving within the oceans. And we're seeing even heat releases in the Arctic seas, which they never thought existed, and they found volcanic vents there that may account for some of the ice disappearing on the North Slope. Then you got another condition happening that people don't really see out of my region of the world. It makes the press every once in a while, but it's the methane releases. As we lose snow cover and we've gained 2 weeks of summer here in Alaska in the last 40 years, on the North Slope of Alaska, that means heat is being absorbed more dramatically into the ground, which is melting permafrost that has remained frozen for over 50,000 years. That permafrost, when it melts, releases vast amounts of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And that release is taking place now across Siberia, Alaska, Canada, at a point where it's now feeding on itself. Even if we stopped everything, that cycle is now getting bigger and bigger each year, and it's irreversible. So the climate change, whether we argue about the cause or we continue to aggravate it with things like HARP, is happening. And now we need to address the solution. Like what's happening in the Bay Area, you know, is happening all over the country. And yet the agricultural impact of that is not yet being felt. Oh. It is going to begin to be felt in the marketplace where you and I as consumers see it, not just the farmer. And that's happening in this next quarter and the quarter following. And that's where
it's
we're going to be.
Amazing how it happened right as we have Tony Blair coming in. We have the movie by Gore, A Convenient Inconvenient Truth or whatever, being released. All of this happened. That's why it's really hard for me not to believe there may be a man-created weather phenomenon going on at this point. It's just too coincidental. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. And part of it,
there's so much going on. It just feels, and then the papers, which are controlled by the government media,
right,
like every day they're hollering about the Levy Schwarzenegger's meeting with Blair, and the climate. We better quit using so much. Quit our quote unquote addiction to gasoline. Now it's being equated to an addiction. I see a lot of media and government complicity going on here.
Absolutely.
In our standard of living.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, the thing about it is they want to blame us for the bulk of the problem, human beings. And, yeah, you know, we're aggravating the situation, no doubt. But nature goes through these cycles. We just happen to be at a peak of a natural cycle, also at the peak of our industrial development as, you know, as a planet, you know. So it's a bad set of coalescing factors, but the reality is we're in this mess, and now the question is, how do we get out? Part of this orchestration and bit of a panic we're seeing may, in fact, be the excuse for why we need to modify the weather. We'll talk more about that right after the break, and we have other callers hanging on. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World on RBN Live. Hang in there with me. We'll get right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 until 1 p.m. Central Time, so pass the word on. We were talking about, and have been talking about, energy and oil-related issues, some of the Alaskan issues affect the rest of the country. Just before the break, we had gotten into the whole issue of weather and climate change and weather modification, and, you know, there's a lot, as Marilyn was saying, a lot of publicity these days on climate change, and you know, is it sort of the beginning of the massaging of the public to go along with whatever the propaganda is going to be that we hear next? And I kind of agree with that. I think part of it may be, in fact, you know, where it's obvious the situation cannot be reversed, containing the American public, getting us to agree on certain things so that our resources are spread around the world. That's, I think, part of the game. The other is maybe to get us ready for the use of this type of technology as a way to save ourselves and maybe create even more of a complicated mess. You know, it could be a little bit of each. At the end of the day, national policy should be directed not at blame, because that's not going to work, but at real solutions. And the first real solution, if indeed oil and gas are responsible, then let's start exploring the alternatives that right now are economically viable. Because they are. I mean, now with the prices the way they are, there's lots of alternatives that cost less, and we ought to be putting some of our national resources into those solutions if indeed this problem really exists. The other issue is, even if we stopped in the Western world everything we were doing in terms of emissions, you're not going to convince China or India or the developing world to do the same until they feel like they've caught up. In other words, there is no reversal. The consequences of climate change, regardless of the cause, are here today, and we need to address that. We need to address the small farmer that's losing the farm, the crops that are dying, cattle that are dying, and people that are dying based upon changes in climate and changes in energy policy. And we need to address them both because they absolutely run together. Marilyn, do you have something else you wanted to add into that? Are you still with me? Okay, I think we have another caller holding on. Are they still with us? Let's go ahead and take that caller. Are you with me?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can indeed. Go ahead. Is this Paul?
Yes, sir. This is Paul in Delaware.
All right.
I got a few issues. We're talking about global warming, but what is more of a pressing issue and a more serious issue is the fact that all this nuclear waste that we're dumping into the ground. And we're destroying this planet, not just with fossil fuels, but there's tons and tons and millions of tons of this nuclear waste that you think global warming's the problem? Wait till this stuff that they're burying in these mountainsides, when an earthquake erupts or happens and erupts these canisters, and this stuff starts spewing all down through the Colorado River and everywhere else around this planet, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, there's a friend of mine, his name is Ben Eastland. He was actually the inventor of the original concepts regarding HAARP, and he has done some work in this particular area of, he started his career with the Atomic Energy Commission back in the 50s. During the 1960s, he and another inventor developed a technology called the fusion torch, and the concept was essentially to address the nuclear waste stream, and at the time, the fusion torch wasn't economical, but there's new things happening there. Hang on, after the top of the hour, we'll be back. Paul, if you hang in with me, I'll give you the rest of that story, because it's a good point and an excellent story on the issue. This is Dr. Nick Begich. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. You're listening to RBN Live, and we have Paul on the line, and we were just talking about nuclear waste as another big problem. And I wanted to get into this fusion torch. Back a couple decades ago, Dr. Eastland and another inventor developed this concept for a fusion torch that would literally reclaim the constituents from the waste stream of atomic reactors, nuclear reactors, basically to grab all of that waste that's piled up since the beginning of the atomic age and reprocess it for reuse with essentially an outstream that has zero radioactivity, or at least just what would be normal in the background and considered safe. That technology, when it was first thought about, the energy in was more than the output. In other words, it wasn't an economical equation. Dr. Eastland has recently filed three new patents to bring that concept into the what's possible in the 21st century. And those patents, I believe, have already been awarded. And if that concept gets funded, it may, in fact, solve the problem, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. Not made any media at this point, and yet Eastland's history and record as a scientist is outstanding. I mean, he has incredible things to his credit. He has authored 53 publications, and he holds either exclusively or with others 21 U.S. patents, and has done articles for publications like Scientific America on controlled fusion plasma research, which happens to be his specialty area. But using plasmas for reclaiming nuclear waste streams, you know, there's another solution, you know, that is not being explored, that ought to be, because if nuclear power is even part of the solution, which everyone is pushing for in certain industrial circles, we have to address the waste stream issue, or it is not a viable option at all. So, you know, even in these things that are being looked at as big issues, the problem is we're not looking at the solution side as aggressively as perhaps we could.
Yeah, I also wanted to comment on, you know, when we're talking about these nuclear problems, what we've done is allow these people to set up a system in which things like solar power and wind power, they will continually tell you it's not feasible, and the reason why is because they own the uranium mines, they own the oil fields, and so they've sold this package to the people. But also, I'd like to touch on the fact that we have many religions, and a lot of people think that religion only comes out of some cathedral or temple or church. But in actuality, the new 21st century religion is space religion. Whether you're looking at the Mormons, or whether you're looking at the Church of Scientology, or whether you're looking at through Anunnaki and the reptilians and all this other stuff, what I've seen is through Hollywood movies, they have painted a picture of this wonderful futuristic space world. And, you know, when I talk to people about the reality of the situation regarding man has never walked on the moon, I ask them just logical questions like, you know, Hubble telescope looks 400,000 light years away. The moon is only 240,000 miles away, but yet we have no satellite, no telescope that can see all these wonderful flags and all this other stuff that's supposed to be there, not to mention the fact that in the 60s, the 20th century, not the 21st, that we took six trips to the moon like we were flying from New York to Paris. And my other logical question to these people who keep on believing that man has walked on the moon is this. Tell me something. Six trips to the moon in the 20th century, tell me this. Why aren't we going back? That's my first question. And my other question is, it was so easy. And there's water on the moon now.
We've got
all these things that are going to Mars, supposedly.
The sound
and on and on the ridiculousness goes of never man having never walked on the face of the moon. But
Paul, we're headed into the break, and I appreciate the call, and I'll make a comment after the break. And thanks, Paul. Thanks for the call. Call in again. And this is Dr. Nick Begich on Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., so pass the word on. We're going to be covering technology issues, which we've been mainly covering. We've got a little off-topic today. you know, the last caller talked about the new science or space science becoming a religion. You know, I think everything can become a religion. You know, religion means to regulate belief when you look at its root meanings, and I think some people think science is a religion. You know, the reality is, you know, people will gravitate to whatever's important to them. You know, the idea of the space program and whether or not we ever made it to the moon is, I've heard this debate before. The sad story is whether we made it or not, we spent a lot of money on a program where we still have grandmothers literally freezing in the dark in the winter and dying of heat exhaustion in the summer. Until those problems are resolved, or as my dad said when he was in the Congress, when the Concorde was being debated, until we fix the road to the airport, we probably don't need a Concorde. And I feel the same way about a lot of the government programs that exist today where they don't address the needs of the average individual. They've left us. Government is now oppressive rather than supportive in a way that government should be. And, you know, I think that's wherein lies the fallacy. Whether we made it to the moon or not, I don't know. I it's not an area that I've really looked into and not one that I'm particularly interested in when so many things right here at home need to be addressed. Dan in Texas, you're still hanging in there with me. Are you still there?
Dr. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing good.
I must say it is a commonsensical, intellectual pleasure to have you on here every Wednesday.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
I have been really enjoying your 2 hours. I have two issues I wanted to ask you about, and I'll listen on the air. Are you familiar with the Reverend Lindsay Williams's The Energy Non-Crisis book and video?
You know, I've not read his book, but I've heard about his material, and it deals with the Gull Island issue. Is that correct?
Right. And
yeah,
he's done numerous interviews on RBN, and I was just curious if you're familiar with his input on that and your take on it. And then secondly, are you familiar with this Leo Wanta issue?
It doesn't ring a bell by that reference.
Greg Zismansky's done recent interviews with Leo Wanta about the efforts to repatriate some $27.5 trillion to the American economy.
I haven't heard this, no.
Well, one day I wish you'd archive Greg's show that, of course, follows yours.
I will check it out. What do you know about when that ran?
There was one day this week, either yesterday or the day before, where he spoke with a guy from Ameritrust.
Yeah.
Who's involved with this process.
I'll take a look at it.
And his interviews with Leo Wanta were, he's had, I know, two of them and maybe three in recent weeks. And, well, since June 12th. And anyway, I'd really appreciate it if between now and next Wednesday you had an opportunity to listen to Greg's interviews with Leo Wanta. I'd sure love to hear your take on that.
All right, I'll take a look at that. In terms of the oil resources in the Gull Island area and in Alaska, you know, these are, many, many people know the truth about what's happening here. You know, there's actually a technology where we could define every oil field in this region easily, and it's the HARP system, which actually has a ground-penetrating tomography capability that they've already tested and proven. Back in 1996, they proved it for the Congress under the non-proliferation and counter-proliferation policies of the federal government. So what we could do, in a safe way, with the right geophysicists involved, we could actually image the entire region of Alaska and determine with certainty, 99.9% certainty, the character, grade, and quality of every onshore and offshore oil and gas field in Alaska. And Brooks Agnew, who is a specialist in earth-penetrating tomography, demonstrated this technology going way back. I mean, over 20 years ago, Halliburton took him around to 26 drill wells in 9 states where he proved this technology worked. Then when HARP actually activated and they proved it when they mapped out underground mining workings in Alaska using this technology. So we could with certainty define where the national resources are located And remember, these are national resources, not private companies' resources.
Right.
We could then very carefully develop those resources and bring them to market. You know, the idea that we have to walk across the seas, you know, if you were a multinational corporation, you would invest your money where you knew you could exploit with the least regulation until they throw you out, like they did in Bolivia and Venezuela and throughout the Middle East and every other place they've ever been. Or you could put your money in what's considered a safe haven. Well, the way it works is you put your money where you make the most first until you get thrown out. And this is their safety deposit box where they know on the backs of the American people and in the panic of the people that they create, they'll get to exploit those resources too, and they'll be the 11th hour resources. And maybe that's good policy for corporations, but it doesn't bode well for the rest of us. And you know, and all of this really does tie together. I mean, it doesn't require someone to sit in a big planning room and map it out. It just takes a certain mindset. And when Wall Street regulates so much of our political outcomes, and Wall Street is driven by profits, and it's driven by this mindset of greed. Capitalism is a good thing. It's a great thing. But it also has to maintain the values and character of the country that allows those institutions to exist. And our multinational corporations have forgotten who's protected them and their shareholders over the last couple of centuries.
Yeah. But in any event, Reverend Williams' statement about the oil at Gull Island that's been capped off.
Yep.
Enough there to easily supply the energy needs of America for 200 years. In any event, this technology is available to either prove or disprove that assertion.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and it's not expensive to implement. And, you know, it's in all of our interest to have it implemented safely and at the same time get that knowledge so we can make more perfect or better decisions. And right now, wildcatting doesn't do well for anyone. You know, if you can eliminate that aspect, and Dan, you're calling from Texas, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you can punch that well with 99.9% certainty, you're going to punch that well and be smiling every day of the week afterwards. In at the same time, most wells are drilled dry, or they just don't hit what they expect. But here's a way to eliminate the uncertainty to such a great degree. It works towards the environment in the sense that you're not exploiting areas that don't have anything to begin with, and you're focusing on what you know versus what you're speculating on. It just changes the dynamic dramatically.
Right.
And the resource revenues that are being derived from these resources, we ought to be diverting a portion of that to get a long-term solution. And there's no plan for a long-term solution. And if this isn't a disaster for the average American, I don't know what is.
Good to have you on, Dr. Nick.
Hey, thanks, Dan, for the call. I've got Alan holding on in Canada. Alan, where are you in Canada?
Hello.
Are you with
nice
me?
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Where are you in Canada?
I'm in Vancouver Island.
All right, great. Well, good to have you. What can I? What do you would like to comment or a question? Or
well, it's about HAARP. And I see there are some positive things with HAARP. The problem with HAARP is threats to the ozone layer.
Well, there's actually two places where HAARP has an impact. You know, if you look at Dr. Eason's original patents on this subject, there is a way to utilize RF radio frequency, which is what HAARP produces. And for those that don't know, and we've talked about it a couple times now, it's a large field of radio frequency antennas based in Alaska that are used for various weapons applications. You can see lots of articles on that at earthpulse.com. If you want to look into that issue. But ozone was an issue that Ben addressed, Dr. Eason addressed directly, and what he said was that you could, in fact, with RF trigger the production of ozone. In other words, you could replenish ozone or you could knock out specific pollutants from the upper atmosphere. And if indeed ozone depletion is truly the problem, not one single experiment along that line has been done with the HAARP system, and it's because the military is controlling it. Ozone, if it really is the problem everyone says it is, this ought to be the first thing it's used for, again, with outside of a military environment and in the open area of science, because it's such a big system. It has to have a multidisciplinary view. There are some real problems with it that we've talked about before, but there are some applications that ought to be considered. The problem is when you hide this stuff in a closet and you start manipulating the planet's weather systems by militaries, we all have a right to be suspect because their mission is different than ours. You know, their mission, in terms of collateral damage, you may sacrifice a few farmers in order to get some national advantage. It's okay as long as we all understand those sacrifices are being made for the right reasons, and that doesn't always happen.
And that's the problem, is the secrets being kept. And the military took control of HAARP in 98, wasn't it?
It was even before. It was jointly run by the Air Force and Navy from its inception, but it was billed as an academic deal of the University of Alaska, and eventually that charade got removed and the reality happened, and it actually shifted from the Navy and Air Force over to DARPA, which does all of the defense research in these areas. In the case of HAARP, they quadrupled the size of the array. There's 180 antennas in this array now. And it's used for a variety of purposes, and unfortunately, the ones we need right now, they're not paying attention to. We're coming up on the break. Hang in with me. We'll continue this right after the break. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. Appreciate you tuning in. We have Alan still hanging in with us. Alan, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
And did you have a further comment you wanted to make or a question?
Did you say it was Bernard Eastland that patented the current HAARP technology in 1985?
That is correct. Ben Eastland was the originator of the concept. He was also the founder of an organizer of ARCO Power Technologies, which was the company originally set up, the subsidiary of Atlantic Reachfield. Ben hired all the original staff, put together the original programs. He went on National Public Radio back in the early 90s. Shortly after that, they began to sort of shuffle him to the sideline, and eventually he was out of the program. And, they've denied his existence, just about. I've gotten to know Dr. Eastland over the years, and I found him to be a very, very brilliant scientist, and one that has really taken a different approach to a lot of his science based on his experience on the HAARP project and our opposition to it. He's taken the position, and he's put in all of his papers he's published since, this caution and comment to other scientists to really take and listen to what others are saying within other disciplines and try and integrate that into their planning so they make better and safer projects. And I know that on weather modification, since HAARP, he has delivered a paper at the University of Pennsylvania, Lehigh campus, back in October last year, where he actually found that you could modify weather using 1,600 times less energy than he thought was needed when he invented HAARP. And his position on that is he doesn't want to give it to the military and won't. He is not interested in seeing this type of technology misapplied, nor is he interested and seeing it developed in a way that's destructive rather than constructive. And in order to be constructive, it needs to be done in the light of day. He's the same inventor of the three recent patents on the fusion torch for nuclear recycling, and he's of the same mind there, that the U.S. government is an obstacle in the way of innovation. And, and on one hand, they've helped him in so many ways, and maybe they'll help him on these projects. But I know one thing, is these are the projects that need funding now, and there's lots of ways to accomplish solutions, but we need to see a little more aggressive and progressive system within our governmental structure to provide the incentives, awards, and grants necessary to pursue the solutions. But first, you have to have a cohesive national policy on energy and energy-related issues as they relate to climate, as they relate to fuel supplies, and as they relate to the waste streams. If we had those national programs with a plan, we have no plan except to panic. And that is not a plan, that's a failure. And we have the biggest failure on the most important economic issue that we faced as a population in decades, and it's the price of energy.
Well, and that comes from leadership, but let's not talk about that at this time.
All right, I'll go with you on that.
I mean, I'm Canadian, and I have a leader which I don't agree with right now, but I can't do anything until my parliament sits.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, though. You know, it's not just...
Hopefully change things. But.
Yeah, and it's not just Americans. Canadians are feeling the same. My friends in Germany, my friends in Great Britain, my friends around the world feel the same about their governments as Americans do. You know, we're kind of arguing with each other from time to time, but the average person in all of these countries is subjected to the same conditions by governments that are oppressive and multinationals that really don't care about you.
Well, I'm afraid our leaders don't care about us, yes, and this may become our death unless we can do something about it individually from the grassroots. But I wanted to say about HARP in the incremental phases, this did some climate changes, storm-related catastrophes, earthquakes, mudslides, volcanic eruptions. So now that the military is in control, it's happening regularly because the fences... What they're doing when they use HARP is they burn chances into the ionosphere.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. Under certain applications, they do indeed, and that changes conditions underneath significantly. Depending on how they use the technology, a lot can happen. We published a book on the subject. In fact, my co-author was Canadian, Gene Manning, and we wrote the book Angels Don't Play This HARP. Over 350 sources are cited there. If you're interested in information on that book, it's at Amazon.com, and it's also on our website at EarthPulse.com. Alan, I appreciate the call. I'm glad to get a Canadian perspective. Please call back in again because these issues affect us all. I've got...
Yes, and follow that Wanta thing because that's big if Americans get that money.
I'll find out about that, and I'll try and address it in a future program. And I appreciate callers suggesting these topics because this is exactly the way we change the way we see this world. I've got someone holding in Arizona, and I'm not able to pronounce your name. Is it Sheldon?
Sheldon.
Okay, Sheldon. What's on your mind today?
I was wondering if you have any information that space shuttles are being used in weather modification.
You know, not so much in necessarily used in weather modification, but I'll tell you an experiment that I really was baffled by years ago, and many will remember this. Do you remember when the space shuttle went up and they were operating in the upper ionosphere and they were dragging this long, what they called a tether. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And it picked up such a big electrostatic charge that it almost blew the shuttle right out of the sky. And as that relates, you know, to shuttles, you know, what were they really doing? I think they were looking for a way to tap the ionosphere as an energy source for low-orbiting space platforms. And the application of that we'll talk about right after the break. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Hang in there with me, Sheldon, and we'll continue this conversation right after the break. Thanks. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live. I'm here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. Pass the word on. Let people know if you're enjoying this show. And if you have comments or questions, you can call in today. You can call in at 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. And Sheldon, are you still with me in Arizona?
Yeah.
All right. I forgot where we were in our conversation here, so you're going to have to remind me or else ask me another question or make another comment.
Well, we were talking about how the space shuttles may be
utilized
in weather modification.
Right.
And, you know, I got my own radio talk show on the Internet. It's called The Light of Day. I read this on my show all the time. I have proof that the shuttles are used in weather modification since September. This came out of a mainstream news article, Evansville Courier, Indiana newspaper, September of 1994. The shuttle Discovery utilized a powerful green laser directed at key sections of North America and other parts of the globe. Pulses from this laser bounced off thick, high clouds over Tropical Storm Debbie in the Caribbean.
Right. I do have, I do have a clipping of, that was an AP story that indicates the same thing. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, it's an AP story, right.
You know, that, you know, all of the NASA, when you look at NASA, you know, in terms of Atmospheric Oceanic Administration, and you look at what all is happening there, certainly weather is a big part of it. But the discovery of and manipulation of weather is another question. You know, would they use the shuttle for observation? Absolutely. Or deliberate manipulation? there's a lot to be learned. You know, green lasers have some very powerful effects. There's actually, if you go to emred.fi on the World Wide Web, you'll find a friend of mine, Anu Michaela, and she uses green lasers specifically for knocking out and affecting biological agents, and she has a great deal of research about that. You know, lasers, green lasers, because of their wavelength, can be very effective for impacting biological agents. So, you know, maybe that was part of this program. You know, that information isn't just held by a few scientists. It's well known within the literature in terms of the effects of various wavelengths and various energy sources for manipulating living organisms.
Oh,
you
know, I appreciate the insight on that.
Not a problem. Take a look again. I'll give you the site again. It's emred.fi. It's and it's an excellent site. Great material on biophysics. Most of it is readable by lay people. You don't need to be a scientist to use that site. And although it's based in Finland, it's in Finnish, and they have an English version posted on the web as well. It's well worth taking a look at.
Yeah, I'll check that out. Most definitely. Now, another thing I wanted to ask you is, there was a patent from HARP that was given to NASA and FEMA. Do you know more about that?
Actually, what it was is Dr. Eastland, after the HARP program was initiated, he was contracted first by the European Space Agency to analyze the use of HARP for weather modification, specifically for affecting tornadoes, you know, as an energy source. And he delivered that paper. It was peer-reviewed in Italy in October, I think it was 99, but I could be off on the year. What then happened is FEMA and NASA contracted with Dr. Eastland to look at the same kind of concept, but instead of using a HARP or a land-based technology, utilizing a satellite-based technology. And he completed that work for FEMA and NASA for weather modification. In fact, a lot of the modeling was done at the University of Oklahoma in their climate change areas, and they actually looked at and done the mathematical modeling to see if that would be a viable possibility. So, yeah, he's done work for him, didn't transfer the patents, but definitely did work for him on this area, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think he's, you know, I got friends in Wisconsin. They say these tornadoes are coming out in the middle of, the news reporters, the meteorologists are stating these tornadoes come out of the middle of nowhere, and, well, maybe NASA's involved in this.
Well, you never know. You know, tornadoes are basically a cold front hitting a warm front, and what happens in terms of this concept, well, the idea was if you heated up that cold front sufficiently, then you wouldn't get this energy differential where you get the shearing wind formation of tornadoes. And my position has always been on it. What if you miss and you heat up an area that is already hot and you make it hotter, you increase the energy differential, increase that shearing, and instead of getting a class one, maybe you get a class three or four. This is why this technology and why Dr. Eastland is convinced that this technology should be addressed in a public, open science, because right now governments around the world are experimenting, private companies are experimenting, and there's, you know, and the effect, I mean, what you do in one place has a dramatic potential effect elsewhere. So someone might experiment in Russia or China or India or South America and yet have an impact on our climate right here in the United States. So we need to be careful, very careful, and Eastland, having researched this area, has concluded that, yes, it's possible to do this on a much grander scale, but the risk involved has to be moderated by an open public process that involves the best in science and a very, very cautious approach.
And well, I appreciate the work you're doing, Nick. You know, we need more talk show hosts talking about weather modification. Chris Gerner always told me, he used to be a host there in RBN, that it is so critical we discuss weather modification.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, Sheldon, these issues, all of these issues are important. We're going to continue to address them. You know, and we, you know, as you know, we gather a lot of research materials. You know, listeners can be a big part of that. You know, we get a lot of material, AP news stories, stories that don't necessarily make it, you know, into our hands. And you can be a committee of one. And if you see things in the news that touch on these topics or ought to be covered, go to my website at earthpulse.com and send us the material. There's a mailing addresses there and information there. If you want to reach us directly, if you're interested in our books or publications or videos, you can also call us at 888-690-1277, 888-690-1277. And I also want to mention the support that we get from the Lay Institute on Technology, which is a Dallas, Texas-based nonprofit corporation. We finally got our 501c3 status approved. And for those in Texas, this is the family that founded Frito-Lay's and later merged it with PepsiCo. It's not the Lay family that's in all the news lately. And actually, Dorothy Lay, one of the daughters of Herman Lay, the founder of Lay Potato Chips and later chairman of PepsiCo, has funded our research and put together a website called layinstitute.org, layinstitute.org. And you'll see the goals and our purposes, and actually it's giving us a greater opportunity to collect and amass and organize our archives so they're available to every researcher and educator in the world. And that's our goal on the website, among others. In fact, the Institute, we have a big meeting coming up to take a look at some of our initiatives for this next year. And sometime after the 23rd of August, in our next show after that, we'll begin talking about what those new initiatives are and how people can get involved. Because there's some good things happening, and we intend to extend that effort much further into the future. And now we're getting a little bit of help to keep us in this work. So we appreciate that, and we want to mention them from time to time for having done that for us. And encourage people to look at that site, layinstitute.org. Get on their mailing list. It's exclusive. It's not shared, but it'll keep you up to date on the latest research we're involved in.
Okay, keep up the fight. Have a good one, Nick.
All right. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. You know, all of these subjects are important ones, and I know all of us have our own issues as well that are important to us. And, you know, part of this program, I hope, is to encourage people to recognize that we really can make a difference. You know, it's not over yet. And until all of us stop breathing. And we have to continue to make the effort and make the kind of changes in our local communities, in our states, and in our regions of the world if we're really going to see a difference. And it has to come. You know, government is constituted by the will of the people, and we forget that way too often. You know, government is constituted by us as human beings, recognizing that a central government can be useful. When it becomes oppressive, it's time for a change. And that change is hitting us now. I mean, when we look at what's happening on these issues, can we press this congressional delegation into waking up and smelling the roses? I don't know, but we got to keep trying. And I think that's the call on all of us to try in our local communities and on the issues that matter. You know, in this issue of HARP we took on years ago, and we've been able to continue to move that issue in the parliaments of Europe. We've never been able to get an effective legislative redress here in the United States, but we don't believe the game is over. In fact, the biggest issues that are facing us today are the very issues we intend to continue to cover on this program and on the many other programs that I appear on as a guest. Technology is, in fact, what drives the 21st century. It's what makes governments strong. So if governments are to spring from the people, then we all need a little bit of technical knowledge. We don't need to know how to build this stuff any more than we know how to fix our modern automobiles these days. An unfortunate side effect of technology. Used to be everybody could fix their car. We can't anymore. And, you know, technology doesn't mean we can't drive that car. In other words, control that policy of what that car is going to do. We don't have to know how to build it. And the same is true whether we're talking about computers, weather modification, privacy-related technologies, or energy-related technologies, or anything else for that matter. We can have that conversation. And I'm hoping that the role this show plays in that process is a translator, where we take some of this complicated science, try and find a simple way to explain it, and yet keep that science intact. So those that are interested in those technical aspects know where to go to find that material. And maybe, just maybe, we see the kind of innovations that might solve some of our problems. And that's something we're actively working on and actively involved with. You know, energy policy, as it relates to all of us, is certainly something we can't escape. It's here. What we're going to see in the coming months is even going to be more dramatic following the election. So let's pay attention to what politicians are saying, and let's try and make energy the center plate of national policy in this next election cycle. We need an energy policy that solves these problems. When you look at the way in which things have been co-opted in the country, you know, the environmental movement, in my opinion, in many respects, has been co-opted to a point where it's ineffective. People who belong to these organizations, many of them mean well and do a lot of good work, but when I look at the output for the dollars spent and what happens as a result of it, it's become a political game. And we see a revolving door between many of the same players going from the environmental community to the industrial public relations office for the oil industry or other industries. Pretty frequent transition. We're not seeing a more constructive view. You know, we're seeing restrictive views, destructive views, but we're not seeing constructive views, and that's what we need right now. Everyone can bring good ideas to the table, but we have to solve the problem, and it isn't by walking backwards in time and all of us living in an agricultural culture, because that's not who many of us in the West are anymore. And quite frankly, the resources that the planet has are sufficient to meet the needs of the 6.6 billion people that live here. What we have to do is become more progressive in the sense of our capitalism. We can be capitalists with American character underlying that. The very value systems that we insist on in the United States in terms of the value of the individual should be applied everywhere our corporations go. And it's not, unfortunately. It is the reason why wherever we go as Americans, we're often hated because of the profile that the corporations leave behind. Most Americans, when they're met on an individual basis, are liked no matter where we travel in the world. The fact is, it's government policy that gets engaged in a way that is counter to the kind of relations we need to maintain. You know, I'm involved with a number of people that I've met over the years that are involved in international development, and there's been a big change even in that concept recently that plays into all of this. You know, in the past, third world development was the idea of Westerners going in and, you know, looking around and saying, hey, you know, people are poor here, they're living in grass huts, they don't have running water, you know, we need to bring them MTV and McDonald's, you know, and I can tell you, it is the most intrusive cultural clash that you could imagine. The corporations look at it as, hey, these are markets, these are consumers. I look at it as these are human beings that deserve the right to self-determination, not determined by a corporation. If they want to live and they're happy in the lifestyle of their culture, I think we need to start learning how to leave people alone. You know, we don't have to impose our values on everyone on the planet. We can share those things that they're interested in that might support their own cultures and leave people alone. The fact is, when we do this, we end up enhancing our international relations rather than degrading them, and we should have enough respect to the right of self-determination because that is a hallmark of what created this country in the first place. But none of our trade policies, none of our national policies support the individual. They support some squishy collective that all of us keep getting shoved into, and that is not, in my view, the American character, and not the character of the country that most of us, consider. You know, what has happened on energy policy, on national policy generally, is a big trade-off. We're traded off every day. I'll give you a good example, even in my own region. Well, the oil companies are experiencing record profits. A few years ago, our governor decided to give them an additional tax incentive. It saved them $50 million, which is a drop in the bucket for the oil industry, who's making billions every quarter. Saved them $50 million. And what they did is the same day the governor signed an order removing a subsidy we used to provide to our elders here because it's very expensive to live in Alaska. We would give our elders $200 in additional money when they hit 65 as addition to their Social Security out of our resources. We cut that program the same year we gave an industry that was making record profits $50 million in equivalent tax incentive. You know, those are the kinds of things I'm talking about. You know, why would you give them an incentive when the incentive is in the marketplace at $71 a barrel, and then you take away people's ability to buy that fuel to heat their home? And that's the kind of person that was impacted by that policy decision. This happens in our states, in our regions, and in our country's policies Most of us don't see it because the mainstream media doesn't report it. And that's why these radio programs and this network is extremely important. You know, people need to support RBN Live. They need to look at what is in the program to keep RBN on the air and keep these programs coming. You know, this is the way national debate was intended to be. Freedom of the press wasn't freedom to say whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. It was the idea that a free press made sure there was an informed public, that lively debate could take place, and that we could resolve our issues on the backs of the average person, not on the backs of some elite, exclusive intellectual club. This country was built on our backs, and it's our backs that carry it today. We're going to come right back after the break. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Call in at 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're heading into our last segment of the day. And this show is brought to you every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And we deal with technology issues. Next week, I'm going to bring on a guest, Richard Allen Miller, if he's available for me. And it looks like he probably is. Is one of the foremost field men in herbal agriculture, which is pretty interesting. He's also got a background in military projects, which is the area we're going to probably touch on a little bit, and then we're going to touch on some of his other areas of expertise. A brilliant scientist, someone that's also a little bit eccentric, makes him a little bit more fun than most, but very brilliant guy, and we're going to try and have him here next Wednesday for a couple of hours. You know, when we're talking about all of these issues, you know, the interesting part of it is, from my perspective at least, is that there's real solutions here. You know, there's real opportunities to take technology and turn that double-edged sword towards serving humankind in a little bit better way. You know, creativity, the very idea that human beings can create, makes us unique. In fact, for those that ascribe to a Christian view, you know, we're created in the image of the Creator, and many other religious views take that same opinion. But what does that really mean? It means that we have this creative capacity to really, literally, change the world. If we apply it and we use it and we recognize it, it is our birthright. It is our obligation as stewards of this planet, as servants of one another, to really amplify and lift up what we can do that is good and constructive, and to put down that which gets in the way. And we need to do it. And we need to do it individually, and we need to do it as a nation, and as a world. And I think that's a mindset that's starting to shift. That level of responsibility and accountability needs to be applied to our governmental institutions. Our institutions need to increase their transparency, which is a big word kicked around in Europe these days. Transparency in government is the call of the people, and what we have is the opposite. We have a intrusive government violating the privacy rights of every American and every citizen of the planet, as if it were their open invitation and right to do so. As we become more transparent as individuals, our governments become opaque, difficult to look into, impossible to discern. That's what needs to change. It's what our friend in Canada was saying earlier about his government, what we said about ours, and what many others are saying around the world. It's time to take a different view. You know, revolution comes in lots of forms. It shouldn't be violent. You know, what we have seen in a lot of places is a revolution in thinking, and that's what's really required today. You know, a lot of the topics that we're going to be covering in future weeks are going to deal with ways to enhance our human potential, to increase our capacity as individuals, to reduce our stress levels and allow us to move forward with a great more vigor in trying to address some of the challenges that we face. If you want to call in these last few minutes, the number is 800-313-9443. And again, I want to remind people of my website. It's EarthPulse, EarthPulse.com. We appreciate folks going there. Take a look at what's there. Lots of articles and information. Pull the information off, pass it on. And our research is also provided by the Lay Institute of Technology based in Dallas, Texas. Again, that site is www.layinstitute.org. for our research information. Again, leyinstitute.org. You've been listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday, 11 a.m. Central Time, and you're listening to RBN Live. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.